It helped that I gave weekly classes and devotional services and thereby exposed people to Master's teachings, instead of leaving them to work out everything for themselves, influenced by a heterogeneous collection of books and friends. I insisted they work on developing solution consciousness, not problem consciousness. It is easy to see a problem, I said. A little harder, perhaps, to define it. But only by solution consciousness will you attract solutions. If you want to draw attention to problems, then suggest solutions for them. Don't just grumble and complain. To point out defects without showing the courage to look for solutions can paralyze people's willpower. If you induce such paralysis in others by negativity, you owe it to them as well as to yourself to offer practical and constructive remedies. One time I learned that a number of people were planning to, quote, call me on the carpet before the community to demand why certain things weren't being done. Well, it was their community, not mine. I forestalled their tactic by calling a meeting myself and listing their complaints. What, I asked everyone, shall we do to remedy these matters? It took the wind quite out of their sails. They themselves had no constructive suggestions to offer. The rest of us did what we could to remedy matters. Actually, I paid little attention to people who were steeped in problem consciousness. The energy it would have taken to persuade them to become constructive would hardly have brought any of them from a minus value to zero. Those who, in later years, worked with such people, from a desire to help them, found, as Jyotish once put it, that 90% of their energy went toward counseling 10% of the members, and even then this 10% usually ended up turning against the community, or, in other ways, letting it down. Perfection is no mere dream. It is everyone's spiritual destiny. In terms of present realities, however, the plain truth is that few people change radically over the course of a single lifetime. The best one can do in one life is refine what he started with. He can't alter his nature drastically. When I was told recently of the arrogance and worldliness of St. Francis of Assisi as a youth, I thought, oh no, he was always an innocent, exuberant, joyful, eager for experience, but never proud or selfish, never worldly in the sense of having an avidity for egoic fulfillment. Worldly people project their worldly attitudes even onto saints. A wonderful thing at Ananda was the fact that, after our first rocky years, community meetings almost always ended in a spirit of harmony. I never insisted on consensus, but if people couldn't agree, I generally shelved a discussion in order to give them time for further consideration. For when people sincerely seek a right solution, and not one they only desire, agreement comes relatively easily. In any case, I was not attached to the outcome. If an idea of mine didn't meet general approval, I simply dropped it. Perhaps my own lack of attachment helped others also to see that mere things are not really all that important. A principle I established, one with which everybody came in time to agree, was people are more important than things. In practice, this means that people's spiritual well-being is more important than anything else. If a job needed to be done, but the best person for it would not benefit from it spiritually, someone else was sought for the job. If no one was found, an entire project was sometimes abandoned. For myself, even if an idea I presented was one I particularly liked, like architectural concepts for the residences, I felt that what mattered most was encouraging people to think for themselves. For if a person's idea is squelched, even for the simple reason that it is wrong, The person may, as a result, feel discouraged from making further suggestions. Thus, if his suggestion isn't drastically wrong, it may be wise to remember that we learn by our mistakes, and therefore to give him a chance to prove himself. If, again, anyone came up with an alternate proposal to one of my own, even if I didn't think it was as good as mine, I often went along with it to encourage that person to think creatively and to develop a sense of personal responsibility. For more important than almost any specific project is that people develop the ability to come up with ideas for projects themselves. Moreover, I sometimes found that an idea that I hadn't considered very good turned out to be better than I'd expected and better than my own, even. It was good in any case and helpful, especially for me personally, to hold myself open to new ideas. The primary goal of leadership in a place like Ananda is not to win admiration, but rather to develop leadership in others. As much as possible, and increasingly so through the years, I helped people to develop their own leadership skills, instead of making all their decisions for them. If someone made a mistake, which, as I've said, is often the best way to develop understanding, one had to consider the type of mistake and people's ability to grow in understanding. To allow a person to keep on erring would be absurd. Sometimes, also, the mistake was my own for expecting too much of someone. It is better always to give people less of a load to carry before burdening them with a heavy one. I said it was important for Ananda not to be sectarian, but to respect others' faiths and include all broadly in our sympathies. I also urged our members not to think of Ananda as separate from society as a whole. Our good, I said, includes the good of everyone, and not that only of Ananda. If our immediate gain means loss for someone else, it is not really a gain at all. Thus, in June 1976, after a forest fire destroyed 450 acres at the farm and 21 of our 22 homes, neighbors phoned us excitedly to announce that the cause of the fire had been a faulty spark arrestor on a county vehicle. "We can sue the county," they enthused, "and get all our money back." I wrote the county supervisors about it, but in a very different vein. "I'm sure you're aware," I said, "that Ananda was the biggest loser in that fire. Perhaps you've been worried about what we'll do about it. I want you to know that we won't be suing. We don't want to take our bad luck out on our fellow citizens by increasing the county's insurance rates. Anything that harms the county will harm Ananda also in the long run." Our neighbors sued and collected. Ananda, on the other hand, faced the real possibility of bankruptcy. Another motto of ours has always been "Jhoto Dharma, Toto Joya." Where there is adherence to truth, there lies victory. We, quote, stuck to our guns, and not only survived, but flourished. Some 20 members, including families, left as a result of that fire. Those who asked us for help were paid out of donations that individuals and other communities were sending us. Only after paying them off did we begin the rebuilding of our own homes. The people who came to Ananda in the beginning were not devotees for the most part. The word soon spread, however, that Ananda's goals were spiritual. In time, non-devotees stopped coming. I didn't force spirituality on anyone. Thus, I also didn't demand that people become disciples of Yogananda, nor that they accept him personally in any sense. These are sacred decisions and must be left to the free will of the individual. I made Master's way attractive to people, however, by sharing with them my own devotion to it. Soon enough, people began not only coming as devotees, but with eagerness to become his disciples. I've always found it difficult to say no to people. My solution to this difficulty was the same as when Master put me in charge of the monks at Mount Washington, to help those who didn't belong to weed themselves out. One way I did so at Ananda was to encourage a spirit of devotion. Faced with this spirit, the freeloaders and naysayers became uncomfortable. In fact, our first need was to make clear to those who came what we were and weren't. As long as we were unclear on our self-definition, it was easy for anyone to think he or she could decide what we ought to be. The veriest newcomer often thought, "Oh, this is my community. Why shouldn't I and those who agree with me have a right to determine what Ananda will be?" Negative energy, fortunately, has little cohesive power, especially when faced with positive energy. People wanted frequent meetings to decide Ananda's future. I let them meet as often as they liked. I didn't often attend those meetings, for I saw no way they'd ever accomplish anything significant. Often all they did was stir up useless emotions. I knew, however, that the success of a community depends primarily on attitude, not on superficial questions like zoning or how much everyone needs to tithe. I also knew that when many voices are raised on every side of an issue, nothing is likely to emerge. There was a dog at Ananda named Blue. Blue caused general consternation by chasing the deers, barking at visitors, and obstructing people in their work. Declamations were made on every aspect of this issue. Unbelievably, it took all of 5 years for everyone to agree that Blue should be taken elsewhere and abandoned. Blue had strayed onto the land in the first place. The positive side of this fascination with minor issues was that the meetings never generated more than one horsepower energy. My own concern was with issues of more far-reaching importance. To achieve my spiritual ends, I found it necessary to accept compromise on certain issues in the name of harmony, and for the sake of things I considered more important, especially the creation of a core of people in whom I felt I could instill a spirit of service and devotion. Meanwhile, therefore, I worked with those whose spirit was positive, those who wanted to build, not merely to complain. I tried also to do what Master did with his disciples, project thought forms toward those who wanted to work with me, rather than spelling out exactly what I wanted each one to do. Thus, they were free to take an idea from me or not as they chose, and work to make it their own instead of coming to me constantly for guidance and approval. I told them they could accept as much or as little of an idea as they liked. If they tuned into it, it became our idea, neither theirs nor mine. Thus, Ananda became our community gradually and grew into a homogeneous spirit. For the thoughts I held and projected were those our guru gave me for our development. Sometimes it appeared to others as though I were merely leaving them to their own devices. Far from it. By tuning in to our guru's guidance and to my own awareness of that guidance, they developed their own inner strength and didn't become weakly dependent on guidance from outside themselves, that is to say, from me. Ananda's true leaders have always been those who tried to tune in, seeking guidance primarily from within themselves. It was, as I had seen, the way Master trained us, if we listened to him inwardly. Ultimately, we all wanted only to project God's will for this time in history, in response to humanity's needs to which God himself was responding. Dick Baker once said to me, "When I die, all this will disappear. The universe has no more reality than I myself give to it. It exists in my own mind. Evidently, this thinking was a product of his Zen training, though I cannot imagine it was the teaching of the Buddha. For although this philosophy crops up from time to time in human thought, it is easily demolished. It simply represents an attempt to exclude God from the scheme of things, and it forces several obvious questions. For instance, could you, Dick Baker, write plays as good as William Shakespeare's, carve statues as good as those of Michelangelo's, build bridges of a grandeur equal to the Golden Gate Bridge, compose a Beethoven symphony, sing like Enrico Caruso? Mind has produced all this, yes, but not your mind, nor mine. We are merely dreaming within a cosmic dream. That one consciousness which dreamed all this brought us into existence as well. The noblest thing we can do in life is to open ourselves, our hearts and minds, to the influence of his dreaming. I didn't insist, to begin with, on people becoming disciples of Master. Bit by bit, however, they did become disciples, or else left to follow some other calling. Our rate of attrition over the years has been remarkably low. Many members today at Ananda came to us in those first years. A suggestion was made early in Ananda's history that we close down the retreat at least for a time and concentrate on developing the community. No, I said, we need to direct our energies outward in service to others and not inward only. Otherwise, God will cease to pour out blessings on us. If no one else wants to serve at the retreat, I'll do it myself, all of it, if necessary. At first, the retreat drained Ananda's coffers, returning nothing of tangible value. In time, however, it became a major income producer for the community. On the other hand, spiritually speaking, it brought much of the energy that built Ananda. I once remarked to my mother, I simply can't understand a wealthy person wanting to build a beautiful home and garden just for himself and his family. Mother replied, that's a novel way of looking at things. And I thought, how strange to look at things in any other way. After my parents died, I wanted to give my inheritance to Ananda. However, I realized that Dad, especially, who had never donated a dime to Ananda, would be restless in his soul if he saw that money going elsewhere than to me. One day he exclaimed to me in exasperation, "You've just got to stop giving all your money away." I, on the other hand, would never have been comfortable keeping it for myself. I then hit on a compromise, build a beautiful home and garden for myself that would serve not only me but the whole community as a spiritual center. Many hundreds, perhaps thousands, have been inspired by Crystal Hermitage as I named my new residence. Actually, I myself rarely get to enjoy it, especially now that I live in Italy. And even at Ananda Village, my work of writing and music composition requires privacy, which is available to me only in my apartment and little garden downstairs. To me, however, when I'm here, the occasional shouts of children around the pool upstairs and the chanting of devotees in the upstairs dome are a greater fulfillment than any sense of proprietorship could be. Only once in Ananda's history have I allowed the thought to enter my mind briefly, it was I who's brought this place into existence. This was one evening during our early years when most members had only trailers to live in. I strolled past these simple dwellings, enjoying the light coming from their windows, and thought, there was darkness here not long ago. It was I who brought soft light to this place. I entertained this thought happily for a few minutes, then put it out of my mind, not in a sense of sacrifice, but in the suddenly vivid awareness that this kind of happiness, though pleasant for a time, was constricting to my consciousness. The smallest hint of ego only imprisons the soul. Beauty, however, was important in my dreams for Ananda and in Ananda's development. Men and women played equal roles in the community from the beginning. It is equally true, however, that each sex is blessed with special gifts, not uniquely, but generally so. Women, for instance, are more naturally inclined to create beautiful surroundings. I urged the women in the community to concentrate on beautifying Ananda. Quite a few of Ananda's homes are aesthetically pleasing and nestle in beautiful gardens. Music, drama, and the visual arts play an important role in Ananda's community life. Recently, the forest land was thinned out to give it a more park-like appearance, which made it possible to plant trees in a greater variety in locations that were carefully thought out in advance. Enjoyment of beauty is a delight to the soul. Attachment to it, however, is a prison. Thus, too, with my own heart's feelings, every time they felt drawn to feminine beauty and tenderness. Even in that inspiration, thoughts wove themselves of personal, egoic fulfillment. For many years, the fear lingered that, thus threatened, the very soul freedom for which I'd come to my guru was in danger. Must I sacrifice salvation itself on the altar of service to him? Could God really ask of me such an enormous sacrifice? Yet I asked myself, how can I liberate myself from sensual and romantic longings when all my energy needs to be devoted to serving this work? If only I thought it were possible to live in a monastery or as a hermit instead of having to mix always with people of both sexes. If I weren't exposed to temptation, wouldn't I at least gain spiritually? Could I run away? Yet this work was what my guru had given me to do. I could see no alternative but to go on, hoping for the best, clinging with faith to his power, believing that he would take me eventually out of delusion. To me personally, the risk was agonizing. Meanwhile, I never pretended to myself or to anyone else that it was not a delusion or might in some way be justifiable. At last, as it happened, I discovered that his blessings had been with me always. Divine Mother sent me someone who satisfied a deep need within me and brought a satisfaction that didn't depend at all on the person involved. Several times I said to her, "Nothing you do or don't do, say or don't say, can affect the blessing you've awakened in my heart. It isn't human love, it's inner completeness." She didn't remain at Ananda. For many years, however, that sense of completeness has remained within me unaltered, a sense of holy sweetness and beauty in which desire plays no role. Love inspires me more now than ever, but a love that embraces everything I see, every person I meet. This love recoils from confinement in any form, as a freed prisoner might from the memory of incarceration in his old cell. It would be foolish to presume on this inner freedom. It is too sacred to be treated lightly. Helping me in this regard is a distaste even for hugging anybody anymore. Love, I feel, is of the spirit, not something to be grasped outwardly. A disciple of Swami Sri Yukteswar has received a similar blessing. Having long suffered from an unfulfilled attraction to human love, he begged his guru to help him win release. One day the guru told him, "Divine Mother will give you a blessing today." They were seated in a train which was standing at a station. Another train next to theirs was just pulling out. "Look there," Sri Yukteswar said. The man glanced across and caught a brief glimpse of a woman, the mere sight of whom forever satisfied his human longing. I can best express through music the feeling of holy upliftment that possessed me. Therefore I tell people, if you want to know me, listen to my music. It is through this music that people have come to understand what Ananda is truly all about, more so, I believe, than through my books. Without the influence of music, Ananda would not be what it is today. Books and lectures are only the outer form of the teachings. Music is its coursing blood. One thing I have always discouraged at Ananda is anything resembling a group attitude. I remember a convent I visited years ago. The nun assigned to greet visitors addressed me in a whisper. "And over there," she said reverently, "we have our chapel, where the nuns pray daily for others. We get up every morning at..." Just then their father confessor arrived with a large box of chocolates as a gift for the community. The tone of her voice suddenly shifted from one of hushed reverence to a squeal of girlish delight. This change has always stood out in my mind as demonstrating the difference between assumed and genuine feeling. Is not God more pleased with us when we share with him what we sincerely feel, instead of mumbling prayers to him from under a cowl of assumed humility? I wrote a song that has become a theme song at Ananda. Walk like a man, even though you walk alone. Why court approval once the road is known? Let come who will, but if they all turn home, the goal still awaits you. Go on alone. Follow your dream, though it lead to worlds unknown. Life's but a shadow, once our dreams have flown. What if men cry your dream is not our own? Your soul knows the answer. Go on alone. Give life your heart. Bless everything that's grown. Fear not the loving, all this world's your own. Make rich the soil, but once the seed is sown, seek freedom, don't linger, go on alone. And then I repeat the first stanza, which I'll sing. Walk like a man, even though you walk alone. Why court approval once the road is known? Let come who will, but if they all turn home, the goal still awaits you. Go on alone. We encourage eccentricity at Ananda. At Mount Washington, by contrast, Arne Lipovic, or Brother Prema Moy, used to say to me, half in appreciation and half in criticism, "You're eccentric." I asked him to explain himself. He replied, "I don't mean you're crazy. What I mean is, you aren't centered in anyone's expectations of you. For instance, you don't hold as sacred necessarily the things others consider solemn and important." When the nuns wanted a new designation for themselves in order to get away from the word nun, you couldn't resist, jokingly I know, that they consider the designation renunciates, or with a more Indian sound, monkinis. That's what I mean. You aren't always reverent enough, and at times when others think it proper to be serious. At Ananda, perhaps infected by my own light attitude toward excessive formality, people are encouraged to be simply themselves, as long as they develop inward devotion to God. I once said to Glenn Dietrich, a friend of Ananda's, that one could usually tell which spiritual group a person belonged to by his outer attitude. Many Hare Krishna devotees tend to imitate the Bengali accent of Prabhupada, their founder. SRF members affected inwardness by excessive solemnity, unaware, perhaps, that Yogananda himself had a delightful sense of humor and would sometimes actually shake with laughter. Glenn surprised me by replying, "I can generally recognize an Ananda member also." I wondered how he could say that when I'd worked so hard to avoid group attitudes. "Please explain," I said. "Well," he replied, "I find everyone I meet from Ananda to be genuine, not artificial. I find the members open to others and willing to listen to their points of view. They talk with people rather than at them. Moreover, I find them all very friendly. It's obvious they care for people as individuals." Well, of such attitudes, of course, what could I do but approve? Something I avoided at Ananda was Indianizing people. This wasn't easy to do, for I myself love the Indian bhav, that is to say, its spiritual attitude. I let my hair grow long again as it had been in India, and I gave Indian names to many of our members. Indian devotional music has always thrilled me. It generates a vibration, however, that in America is not here and now. "Wherever God places us," I said finally, "there he must come to us." More and more, therefore, I withdrew from practices that took us away from our present realities. After all, we lived in America now, and were doing a work designed to spiritualize Americans, not to Indianize them. My basic goal was to inspire people everywhere to embrace a more spiritual outlook. This could not be accomplished if we created a separate identity for ourselves and withdrew mentally from the rest of society. I didn't push unnatural theories on our members, such as strict communal ownership or strict poverty. Nor did I tell them they had to give everything to Ananda. Rather, I tried to help them to grow beyond the life to which they were already accustomed toward a new and better way of living. I saw to it that people received an income which they were allowed to keep or spend as they liked. For myself, however, I accepted no salary. Seva and others tried to insist that I receive one, but whatever money I needed I earned outside the community by lecturing and teaching, and most of that money, even, went to Ananda. Thus others developed similar attitudes of sharing, and soon thought no more of earning for themselves. It became quite the norm at Ananda, in fact, for department heads to receive lower wages than some of those working under them whose financial needs were greater than their own. The devotee's outlook is fundamentally different from that of the worldly person. For one thing, where worldly people define wealth in terms of acquisition, the devotee defines it in terms of inner happiness. Where the worldly person defines fulfillment in terms of a desire satisfied, the devotee defines it in terms of desires transcended. Security to the devotee is not a bank account, but a sense of constant inner peace. Inner renunciation is the way to true fulfillment. The true devotee is not interested in owning anything personally. He thinks only of serving God, and he sees God as the sole doer. To God, the devotee gives all the credit for anything he or she does. I myself naturally like people, as I've already said. I see them, however, as souls primarily, not as personalities. In speaking to them, I've always done my best to address their souls rather than their egos. Thus, what others thought of me, or whether they even liked me, did not generally matter to me. of supreme importance where my relations with them were concerned was the reflection that all of us are fellow pilgrims on the long climb toward God. My love for them was impersonal, in the sense that, basing my attitude on my guru's example, I wanted nothing from others. My love was also, on the other hand, deeply personal, in the sense that I wanted the best for everyone. I wasn't always pleasing to them, for what I wanted wasn't always what their egos wanted. My desire was to help their souls to emerge from the chrysalis of ego attachment and soar in spirit. Sometimes in the process I made enemies. I never compromised my soul friendship for them, however. We made other requirements of people, partly to sift out the superficial seekers and partly to help Ananda to meet its expenses. I asked, as a condition of membership, that people pay a fee of $1,000 for individuals and $1,500 for couples after they'd been accepted for residency. This seemed to me a minor sacrifice to make, as a demonstration of one's sincerity and commitment. This is still the practice, though the amount was lowered in recent years, compensated for by the cost of the training they received. We also asked people to help with monthly maintenance costs and other ongoing expenses. And there was, of course, the monthly mortgage of $1,750. For some time, I accepted the burden of paying the mortgage myself. It meant my continuing with nightly classes in various cities. It was only after a year, as people came to consider Ananda their own, that this burden was taken off my hands. In 1969, I wrote a correspondence course as a means of helping people to support Ananda. The course was limited at first to Hatha Yoga, the postures, for I didn't want my lessons to compete with SRF's correspondence course. In time, however, I grew dissatisfied with the thought that what I'd written didn't wholly express my true heart's feelings. Thus, I rewrote the lessons, approaching the teaching not as SRF had done in its lessons, but rather as Paramahansa Yogananda had done once, approaching them in classes he'd given on Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. I moved out of my apartment in San Francisco in June 1969 and settled in my little house at Ananda. Soon after that, we rented a large apartment house on California Street in San Francisco, which served as a sort of halfway house where people could live before moving to Ananda. For the rest of 1969, this apartment house was my main base of operations. From January to May 1970, I rented a small house in the southern part of Sacramento to be closer to Ananda. For nearly a year, I gave yoga classes every evening from Sunday to Friday, then drove up to Ananda. Late Friday evening, I dictated my correspondence lessons, while Suzanne Hunsinger, Bharati, as I later named her, who had been a professional secretary, scribbled industriously. This took me late into Friday night. Early Saturday morning, I led a strolling kirtan through the grounds to the temple, followed by a group meditation. Later, I gave classes for retreatants and residents. Saturday afternoon, I held interviews, then recorded my weekly radio program. Saturday evening, I usually gave a concert and a talk. Sunday morning, there was the weekly devotional service. It wasn't until 1986 near Assisi, Italy, that I wrote the Festival of Light, used since then every Sunday. Sunday afternoon I drove back to Sacramento, there to begin my weekly schedule all over again. It was a busy time for me. In later years others could help out, Jyotish, of course, acting as my mainstay. We have a motto at Ananda, "Many hands make a miracle." This truth has been ingrained in us over the years. I didn't build Ananda alone. All I did, really, was give it the push it needed. Many hands, many voices, many minds made the miracle that eventually emerged. Thus, we also have another theme song at Ananda, one I wrote some years after the first one. Many hands make a miracle. Let's all join hands together. Life on earth is so wonderful. When people laugh and dance and struggle as friends, then all their dreams achieve their ends. Many hands make a miracle, people climbing together. Soon we reach to the pinnacle of every mountain peak we hazard as one. We'll lift our hands to welcome the sun. We lift our hands to welcome the sun. Let me sing the last stanza. Many hands make a miracle, people climbing together. Soon we reach to the pinnacle of every mountain peak we hazard as one. We lift our hands to welcome the sun. We lift our hands to welcome the sun.